more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study.
You guys are sort of all over the world, it seems like.
It's kind of mind-blowing when you think about it.
Here on Inspiration Dissemination.
Photographs of this data set stretching over a much longer period of time.
They're now converted into basically mathematical shapes, and we can now analyze the statistics of this shape.
Good evening, listeners.
Good evening, listeners.
It's time for another episode of Inspiration Dissemination. I'm Lillian Padgett-Cobb.
And I'm Daniel Watkins. At Oregon State, we have more than 4,000 graduate students in over 80 different programs of study. And here on Inspiration Dissemination, we feature the research and personal stories of one of these students each week. If you're a graduate student at OSU and you're interested in coming on the show, or you just want to find out more about all the awesome things going on at Oregon State, check out our blog at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration, where you can find out all about our up-and-coming guests and links to our Twitter and Facebook pages.
Inspiration Dissemination is recorded live, and any opinions expressed on the show are those of the hosts and their guests and do not necessarily represent Oregon State University or this station. We are joined by Jasmine Brown from the Department of Forestry, Ecosystems, and Society. Hey, Jasmine.
Hello there. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being on the show. We're wondering, can you tell us a bit about what it is that you do for your research?
I am currently researching diversity and inclusion in natural resources. And this term it's a very loaded term. Diversity can mean multiple different things. Some people think it refers to biodiversity, maybe habitat diversity, and even species diversity. But I am particularly interested in racial and ethnic diversity and also gender. So it's very important for me to be specific about the language and the terms that I'm using. And that's the beginning of my research.
So you've needed to be very creative in finding materials for your research. What are some of the ways that you found successful in finding the information that you need?
Oh, that's a really good question. It's interesting because I found out really quickly that Google and Google Scholar was not equipped to tell the differences between species diversity and racial or ethnic diversity. They're both basically listed under the same term, which is diversity. So if I'm looking for one source that talks about maybe Black foresters as opposed to fish, they're both included in the same search terms. So I ended up having to think of a different way or markers of diversity to find the articles I was looking for. Some examples included, I had to type in minorities, underrepresented, I had to type in women, female. Those are some of the terms that I had to use in order to just find sources for my topic of study.
So just that ambiguity of language seems like it would have been a barrier to beginning your research. So can you tell us, how did this process develop where you identified that you had this idea that you wanted to study, but it was difficult to obtain the materials to study it?
Thank you. I would say this is a long journey, probably longer than I realized. It started during my senior year as an undergrad. I was given a project and my teacher allowed me to research Black women in forestry. I ended up having to give her an annotated bibliography. So she said, okay, you have to find some sort of scientific source or article about Black women in forestry. And I said, okay. So as a novice researcher in my senior year in college, I had no idea what keywords or search terms were. I didn't know you could search journal databases. So I had just typed in Black women in forestry. And I was getting things about like Black oak, different other species, other things involved in forestry, but I couldn't find articles about Black women. So that is exactly what piqued my interest. I had said, okay, well, why is it so hard for me to find an article about myself? Why can't I find articles just about Black foresters? And that's initially what piqued my interest in wanting to find sources about diversity and natural resources.
So my understanding is that you've been a pioneer in a few different ways. What has been the response as you've talked to other minority women in forestry about your research topic?
They've had a lot of the same responses as me. They too, as professionals in this field, do not typically find themselves in the scholarly literature within natural resources. So it always almost ends up having us ask the question, well, where are we? Are we represented within the literature? Not even photos, not other campaigns about natural resources careers. Can I just find myself in an article? And that's basically what got me really excited to research this.
So, and going back to this idea of the looking at the diversity and inclusion in language, so can you describe a little bit about what specifically you mean? Like, you talked about not being represented in the literature. So it's like this idea of sort of your identity being at the intersection of multiple identities and of that process of that challenge, basically.
Yes, you bring up a very good point, and that's initially where some of my questions lied. I knew that as a Black woman that race and gender were both a part of my experience, whether it be at school, in a professional setting, just my day-to-day life. So when I would look at different forestry articles that talked about diversity, that talked about minorities, they would always use the term minority or woman. And I said, okay, so if I'm both a minority and a woman, where do I fall? What category do you create for people who have intersecting identities? And that's basically what ended up having me be more specific about my search terms and about how I'm finding articles. If you're using terms such as minority or woman and not realizing that you're excluding an entire group of people, ultimately you can't expect the literature you're writing to be representative of that entire profession or industry.
Yeah. And despite the fact that the demographics of the field that you're in they're changing, that language usage has not caught up with the changing demographic. And so you're at that position of recognizing or bringing awareness to sort of these out of date language conventions.
Yes, and that's a really good point that you bring up, because historically, natural resource professions such as forestry, fisheries, wildlife, they've been predominantly white and male. And even today in 2019, the profession is still predominantly white and male. Recent statistics that I had looked up said it was still 75% white. So if we're thinking about changes in diversity, are we really, really excited that we have this 2, 3, 4, 5% increase in different races and also in different genders? I guess that's primarily the question I keep asking myself, is like, what will it take for natural resource professions to look completely different than the way that they do now? When will we stop referring to natural resource profession as predominantly or historically white and male?
One of the things that's made your experience at Oregon State somewhat unique is the flexibility you've had in putting together your degree. You had to look elsewhere than forestry to get some of the training that you needed for performing this research. Could you speak to that?
That is very true. When I had started my program, I knew that I wanted a flexible degree. And thankfully, the Forest Ecosystems and Society program in the College of Forestry at OSU had zero required courses when I signed up. So that meant that I could tailor my master's degree to be exactly what I needed it to be for my research. So I'm very thankful for that opportunity, because it gave me the chance to take courses in ethnic studies. I got to take courses in sociology, philosophy, even public policy courses too. So I realized that I needed training outside of forestry. I needed to understand more qualitative methods, like how do you ask questions that are not typically asked within your profession? I didn't really have a model to go off of as far as someone coming before me and saying, hey, let's look at the big picture. Let's see how this conversation about diversity and inclusion in natural resources has taken place. So I had to rely on professions that are asking those questions. And definitely the social sciences was one of them. I know that the conversation about diversity in higher education, for example, in the workplace is very popular, and it's been going on for a while. So I was able to kind of take some of the lessons I learned from reading about diversity in higher education and apply those to my work here with looking at diversity and natural resources.
And the way that you performed your research was that you performed you implemented a systematic review, which is a specific method typical in social and biomedical sciences. And can you tell us a bit about how you mentioned earlier how you developed specific terminology or search terms to identify the relevant literature? Can you speak a bit more about the specifics of your systematic review that really formed the basis of your identifying all of this wide body of literature?
Yes, I'm going to answer this question in parts.
Okay.
So for the first part, if there is a budding researcher on a topic, for example, this happens a lot in classes and when you're just starting a project, usually your principal investigator or advisor will say, okay, go read all the literature you can find about such and such a topic. Let's say, I don't know, green leaves, for example. And you'll go in, you'll find, okay, well, who started this conversation? Who are the main key players? Where does literature about green leaves typically get published? You'll basically be able to pick up all of those methods, all the understanding about how that conversation about green leaves has taken place. And from that, then you'll be able to say, okay, these are the most important articles. This one got cited the most. Now I know I have a better understanding about green leaves. And you go on from there. I was not able to have that same starting point when I wanted to research diversity and inclusion in natural resources. I would go to some professors and say, hey, I'm really excited to study this topic. And they were saying, oh, you mean tree diversity or habitat diversity? And I was like, okay, I'm back to square one with my terminology not being specific enough. I have to let them know I'm interested in people. I want to study racial, ethnic, and gender diversity. So then from that, the conversation was, okay, Jasmine, I don't think you're going to be able to find enough sources that talk about diversity. And I said, I know that that's false because I already tried this during my senior year in college. I was like, I know these articles exist. We just have to find them. And they said, okay, well, how are you going to find them? Or where are you going to find them? And I said, okay, I don't have a way of answering these questions. I know if I just do a regular lit review, if I just come up with a list of sources, they're going to come back with more questions. And that's exactly what happened. I ended up doing like a preliminary search. I just came up with some random terms, typed them into Google and said, okay, here's what I found. And my principal investigator at the time said, where did you find these? How did you find them? And I said, okay, so you're telling me I have to do some sort of lit review that tracks every decision I make, every keyword I use, every database that I type into. And I had no idea. I didn't even know you could do such an in-depth and meticulous review like that until I was working with a research librarian. And she said, hey, there's different types of literature reviews. And I was like, no way. You've got to be kidding me. And she thankfully said, yes, I think what you're looking for is a systematic review. And I was like, I've never heard of this. She was like, it's really popular in the health sciences. I was like, I'm not in the health sciences. Will this work? And she was like, yes, I found several sources in environmental sciences and conservation that have done exactly what you are trying to do, just on a different topic. So we were able to basically go from there, and we ended up coming up with search terms. We came up with popular journals in forestry, in fisheries, in wildlife, and said, okay, this is where we're going to start. And we basically ended up tracking every decision I made, when the date, basically the date of the search, how many sources I found, and basically that was able to have me build up a reliable body of work to say, okay, this is where this conversation is taking place and how.
So growing up in Connecticut, you maybe had a different idea of what a forest was and what forestry was than you did after coming to Oregon. How has that understanding evolved for you?
Oh, I don't even know where to start. I would say growing up in Connecticut, I did not know that the U.S. Forest Service existed until maybe my 20s. There are no national forests in the state of Connecticut. It's not as if I knew that there was an entire federal agency that manages our natural lands. I didn't really have a good understanding of natural resources careers. I knew I had a really good understanding of trees. I had a good understanding of parks. maybe tree islands in the middle of a busy street, but as far as a forest, as far as just acres and acres of untouched land, like that wasn't something that I could even grasp. Not even thinking of like forests, I always thought of them as, okay, there's houses there. There's gotta be some sort of civilization. And that was a completely different concept. And I would say I didn't really grasp all the career options in forestry until I ended up taking different internship options with private and federal agencies and just kind of expanding my bounds and definitely going to Oregon also helped.
So in the process of unearthing this literature that was relevant to your research topic, what sort of sources did you end up finding, like from academic journals or from elsewhere? Can you delve into that a bit?
Yeah, it was really exciting early on because typically when you're doing a systematic review, you usually will go in knowing, okay, this is exactly my research question, and this is exactly how I'm going to find the literature that answers that research question. I did not have either of those two requirements. My systematic review was definitely exploratory, especially because I had a lot of professionals that were already telling me, Jasmine, this body of work does not exist. We have not been talking about diversity and natural resources for long. This is a new topic. I had a lot of people doubting whether or not I'd be able to find the work. And so it was already hard for me to develop a research question because I was like, I'm trying to just find a body of literature about a topic that people are saying we have not been talking about. So it wasn't until I completed my systematic review that I tracked every decision that I made that I was able to come back and definitely in a scientific and researcher fashion and say, hey, listen, first of all, like slow down, listen. I found over 260 sources and they date back 100 years. So that basically allowed me to enter rooms and have an honest and deep conversation about my research topic. It was no longer able to be brushed off. I was no longer able to just accept people's doubts. They said, okay, well, wow, I didn't think about that. I didn't know that we have been talking about it that much. And then I was able to get everyone on the same page as me to say, okay, well, if we've been talking about diversity and inclusion in natural resources for over 100 years, and you have over 260 sources to support that, why is the conversation not moving? Why are we still facing a predominantly white and predominantly male profession? And from that, everyone was like, okay, well, we're on board. We understand exactly what you're pushing for now. How can we support you? So in terms of some of the sources that I found, I knew that I wanted to focus on either scientific or academic sources. So I had to narrow it down, and I sadly was not able to include things such as books or maybe like magazine articles, but I definitely was able to include journal articles, theses, dissertations, conference papers, technical reports. So I definitely have a wide range of sources, which also shows that there's multiple ways that we are having this conversation in very different forms.
Now, how has the way that you've thought about scientific process and writing changed through your research?
It's changed a lot, I would say. Especially coming in as a master's student, I was already taking courses, like scientific writing courses that said, okay, Jasmine, if you're writing a journal article, you have to have a really good title, you have to have keywords, your article needs to have an abstract, you need to have references, you need to refer to those who are writing about the same topic before you. And I basically debunked or shattered all of those assumptions once I had started digging into the text in this body of literature. It was really hard for me to find sources that had keywords, as far as also assuming that abstracts was a given. That is definitely not true. I also had to look at, okay, well, how many sources have reference lists? And it was just basic assumptions that we assume are included in scientific or academic literature that I was not seeing show up consistently and at a high rate within this body of literature. So then I ended up having to ask myself, okay, Jasmine, well, if someone was to write an article about diversity and inclusion in natural resources and not have an abstract, not have keywords, not have a method section, and not have a reference list, what is that body of work doing? What is that article trying to say, or what are they trying to get across? And that basically had me ask more questions about the rigorousness of this conversation. It's generally expected that a scientific scholarly conversation will have these things. So if the body of literature that I'm looking at does not or has them at a lower rate than what's expected, then what does that mean? And that's exactly the kind of questions I'm looking at right now with my data analysis.
So can you tell us preliminarily any findings that you have from combing through all of this literature? What were your big picture takeaways?
That is a really good question. So in terms of my big picture takeaways, it's interesting to see that the number of articles published on diversity and inclusion has increased significantly. In 1919 and 1920, there were one article was published in both of those years about diversity and inclusion. In the years ranging from 2010 to 2019, 76 different articles were published on diversity and inclusion in natural resources. So if we're thinking about the general increase in the amount of authors that are saying, okay, you know what, this topic is important enough for me to sit down and write an article on it, it's definitely showing that it's a growing concern and that this concern has existed for over 100 years. So in terms of that, that's one of my big picture takeaways, because recently there's been an increase of diversity and inclusion panels, events, committees, especially in academic spaces. So it was funny for me to talk to faculty and say, oh, well, especially at the College of Forestry, to say, oh, our diversity and inclusion committee is maybe 4 years old. This is a new conversation. I said, no, it's a committee that's a part of the same conversation we've been having in this profession for over 100 years. And that definitely changed a lot of people's viewpoints to say, okay, well, we've been talking about this. What have we been doing and what's not working? We need to kind of change our approach if we're hoping to move this conversation forward.
Another thing I'm wondering is, how have you noticed in sort of maybe a progression over time, have the methods used to do the science, have those also changed?
Yes, they've definitely changed. Early on, I was finding a lot of programs that used what's called practitioner methods. So typically a practitioner method is someone in the field that went out and did something. Let's say they held they put together a workshop or they put together a program specifically for minorities in forestry, minorities in fisheries and wildlife. And then they would write a paper about the program. They would tell you what the goal of the program was, what the objectives were, who partnered with them to have the program or maybe the workshop. And they would write an entire paper about this. And this paper with no reference list, with no abstract, no keywords, would be considered peer-reviewed at that point in time. So now what I'm seeing is we're having more articles that do have more methods, that do have abstracts. The methods they're using are typically surveys or questionnaires. I'm seeing an influx of also interviews too. So there's definitely a lot of qualitative methods. I've seen some quantitative, as in like statistical analysis, but definitely I would say the methods have changed over time. And also 40% of the articles in this body of literature did not have a method section at all. So in terms of me looking at this body of literature and assuming that I would only find research methods that would be quantitative or qualitative, I had to abandon that assumption and say, okay, I'm seeing a lot of articles just about a workshop or about a program. Does that count? And I ended up having to go back, kind of rethink that assumption that a method is only applied to research and say, okay, this is, I guess, an action-based, this is someone showing you how to implement this program or this workshop. And I ended up having to count that as a method also.
So it also seems like while there may be like better identification of barriers to diversification, what sort of steps moving forward are in place to maybe rectify some of these and, make change towards or implementing change?
That's a really good question. I would say that my mind had already jumped to that conclusion. I initially started this project and I just wanted to know, well, why is this conversation still taking place? Can we just get past where we are right now? I want to stop referring to the profession that I love so much as predominantly white and male. I want to feel welcome. I want to be included. And I said, okay, I have to step back. Let me see if I can come up with research questions, think of a method that would help me answer that question, find it within the text, and then from that, go from there. I would say definitely one of the products of my work is I'm going to make the data set that I have with the 260 plus articles publicly available. So I feel like that will definitely be a very important first step. I know I'm not going to be the first and the last researcher that's in natural resources that wants to take a look at the big picture, especially because we know that over time, authors have begun publishing more and more and more about this topic in natural resources. So I'm hoping that that would save someone the time of doing something that was already done. You don't have to keep reinventing the wheel, especially if that study or that survey or that program was already written about. So I'm definitely hoping that by having all of the sources publicly available, I'm really excited to see what other researchers after me maybe do with that data or how they're able to manipulate it too. But there's so much, like reading the text, just reading everything we've already written about diversity and inclusion in natural resources is so rich. It's very revealing about what maybe what's important to us, also about who is important to us. So I definitely am excited to make sure that someone else does not have to sit down and invest 8 months of their time just to unearth this entire body of literature.
Yeah.
What do you see yourself doing next after you finish this degree?
Several things. I will continue on to get my doctorate and continue researching the same thing. I'm also excited to continue encouraging youth of color to become more interested in natural resources and environmental careers. Working with high school students and talking about my experience has been really enlightening to me, especially because I've had students come up to me and say, wow, I've never seen a Black person in the woods, or I've never met a Black woman in forest. And I was like, that should not be a rarity. It should not still be a rarity, especially because I know I have other friends who are Black women in forestry. So it's almost me realizing like I'm not nearly as rare as I think. And that definitely changes how I approach my work and my future career activities.
You've also been working for the U.S. Forest Service alongside your degree. And I'm wondering, how has that informed or sort of impacted your degree here?
I'd say that's definitely impacted and informed my research in several ways. I was working for the Forest Service before I started grad school. And when I started working for the Forest Service, I was strictly focused on being a forester, on being a forest technician, walking around in the woods. That was my thing. And it wasn't until a few months into my job that I realized I was having a completely different experience as opposed to my peers who are predominantly white and male. They would come to me and say, hey, Jasmine, you're not a forester, you're a Black forester. And I was like, I don't really want to talk about race today. I just want to be in the woods like everyone else. And I would have so many people come up to me and say, oh my gosh, I've never seen someone like you. And it was from that I started to realize, you know what? My identity is a part of who I am as a professional, as a person. I want to research this more. I want to look into how this takes place in other settings. And that's definitely what influenced me to go back to grad school.
And so after you're finishing up the third year of your master's, you're starting your third year, correct?
Yes. Yep.
And afterward, you're going to do a PhD. And what are your sort of your long-term goals that you see for yourself?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I don't think I've thought about this. First, I would say aspiring to get a PhD is definitely a long-term goal. I had no idea, like a master's versus a PhD, those are completely different degree programs. So that for me is definitely a long-term goal. Outside of that, I see myself continuing to work in higher education and just making sure that I'm involved in pushing the conversation forward. I'd say I've had so many professionals come to me just as a Black woman at a forestry conference, at a forestry event, and say, wow, there's no Black people in forestry. And I was like, huh. Let's have a conversation about that. Like, let's challenge that stereotype. Let's challenge that assumption. And it just so happens to be that my research as a master's student has definitely helped push those conversations that I have that can sometimes be tough to have, especially when everyone just wants to focus on the trees or what's in front of them. I was like, we all bring biases and stereotypes with us. Let's challenge some of those, especially if all I do is research. If all I do is research those stereotypes about minorities in forestry, let's go ahead and look into that.
So the next thing we do as part of our interview is we ask for a piece of advice. And I wanted to ask if there's something that you would like to pass on to yourself at an earlier stage of your academic career or someone who's considering graduate school?
Or an audience of your choice.
Yes.
Oh, or an audience of my choice. Okay. Let's see. I would say my message to anyone considering grad school is definitely do your research. I sometimes wish that I had taken more courses outside of forestry as an undergrad, just so I would know about all the other possibilities outside of forestry. Sometimes can be very limiting if you're approaching a problem and you're trying to answer it only with the tools that your discipline has given you. You have to sometimes accept and say, okay, I may not be able to answer this question. I will have to take other courses. I will have to step outside of my comfort zone. So I would say that's been the most beneficial thing for me, is abandoning certain titles. I had to let go of, okay, you're just a forester. I was like, no, I'm also a social scientist. I'm also a qualitative researcher, and I also enjoy CrossFit, for example. So it's kind of thinking about expanding how you view yourself. Let's see, if I had to send a message to my family and close friends and loved ones, because I'm most likely going to have them listen to this, it would be, I'm almost finished. I'm literally almost finished. Every time they ask me, like, how is it going? I'm like, I'm just chugging along over here. But I've appreciated their support throughout this entire process, and I'm excited to share more about my research.
Well, thank you, Jasmine.
Yeah.
We've been really glad to have you on the show. It was an empowering message.
Yes. Thank you so much. I'm happy we were able to figure everything out with this interview.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. If you want to support the show, please tell your friends about it and give a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts so other podcast peeps can find our show.
The theme music was performed by the OSU Drumline, and the intro jingle was created by Olin Hannum. Special thanks to the supporting staff for KBVR that allowed this show and podcast to be possible.
The show was started by Gian Convar and Joey Holber in 2012. Its hosts include Matt McConnell, Steve Friedman, Mackenzie Smith, Kristen Finch, Adrian Gallo, Lillian Paget Cobb, Lori Lutz, Heather Forsyth, Maggie Exton, Scott Classic, Marcus Weinman, Daniel Watkins, and Harrison Steierwalt.
To learn about other graduate students at Oregon State, or if you want to be part of the show, please visit our well-curated website at blogs.oregonstate.edu/inspiration.
And finally, don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at KBVRID and Facebook at Inspiration Dissemination.
Thank you for listening, and stay curious, my friends.